The C Word is an Odyssey podcast.
Baseball fans, think you know who's hitting a homer today? Well, FanDuel is giving you a free chance to call your shot with daily dingers. Joining the action is easy. Just make your free pick on who's hitting a home run in their game, and if you're right, you'll get a profit boost to use on your next bet for a chance at extra winnings. You've got nothing to lose and a lot to gain. And don't forget, you can make a free pick every day during the MLB season. It's just another reason why FanDuel is the home for home runs. So, are you ready to play your game today? Join all the action at FanDuel.com/podcast. That's FanDuel.com/podcast to play daily dingers and make your free pick on who's hitting a homer. Play ball and swing for the fences on FanDuel, an official partner of the MLB.
Must be 21 plus and present in Ohio. First online real money wager only. $5 first deposit required. A bonus issued as non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire 7 days after receipt. Restrictions apply. See terms at sportsbook.fanduel.com. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
There. So this is part two of Winona Ryder's story. We'll be picking up where we left off in our last episode.
I'm not your mom, but if you haven't listened to part one yet, you should probably go back and do that.
Yep.
You wanna know if I'll survive?
Welcome back to The C Word, a Luminary podcast production. This is a show where we discuss women whose society deemed mad, sad, or just plain bad. And we attempt to untangle what they really were beyond their wild reputations.
We are going to talk about women who've been called crazy by sifting through the cultural trash heap of history, one rumor at a time.
I'm the biggest cunt in Hollywood, Lena Dunham.
And I'm Alyssa Bennett, historian of bad behavior.
And we will never call you crazy.
Listen, before we get going here, we don't claim to know all the facts. We're just passionate students of these interesting women in history, and we are trying to focus a lens on how and why they achieved their bad notoriety.
This is a discussion about what various people have said about these women over the years. We're not saying that every statement or account we'll be discussing is necessarily true, so if you hear something that piques your interest, we encourage you to do your own investigation.
Our hearts are in the right place, and together, we can try to get to the bottom of what has been said about these women over time.
So before we dive back into the height of Winona's career, let's recap a little on part one. Alyssa, what can you tell us about what we've heard for the lazy motherfuckers who don't want to go back and just listen to an hour of us chatting?
At the end of part one, Winona was not in great shape. She was a huge movie star, a major it girl of the 1990s, but she was overworked, she was exhausted, and her breakup with celebrity Johnny Depp and the ensuing tabloid frenzy hurt her feelings. It wasn't going good. And so she ended up spending time in a psychiatric hospital where she was prescribed Klonopin for, quote, anticipatory nostalgia. That's why you have to listen to episode one, because you won't know what the fuck that is unless you've heard us explain.
But I will say that if I could be prescribed pills for every time I had nostalgia, let's just say it would be a very different life.
We are returning to her story just as she's come out of this bad moment. She's ready to get back to work and take on more serious roles. She's read Girl Interrupted and is determined to make it into a movie, and it's still the 90s. So things are looking up despite the shit in the 2000s that's waiting over the cliff. It's a fire when you fall over the side of the cliff.
Yeah. By the way, do you remember that in the class where we met, when we had to write about a very specific group of people, like we had to write like a sociological deep dive?
I can say what you wrote about right now because it's seared in my memory.
What was it?
It was about like the transgressive potential of a yarmulke. 100%. I remember.
Well, I did write about the transgressive potential of a yarmulke, but I also wrote a paper about it girls of St. Anne's school.
Oh, I don't remember that one at all.
I was like, let's take the concept of it girls and apply it to my high school I just graduated from 8 months ago. And I remember you were like, this is a good topic. And I was like, thanks. But yes, the transgressive potential of a yarmulke was my topic.
Yeah.
And and you came in full Victorian morning garb, which is, and by the way, I thought you looked like Winona Ryder.
Oh, God bless. So here we go.
I thought you looked like Winona Ryder in The Age of Innocence, the next film she shoots in this. So I'm tying it all in.
A really like an abysmal performance, if you ask me.
I think Age of Innocence is one of those movies that, like, you enjoy just because you're so fucking attached to, like,
Edith
drama.
Wharton. Well, you know what? I have thoughts about it. I just watched it in my Winona marathon, and we're going to get there.
But, you know, the film is released in the fall of 1993. It's a Martin Scorsese joint, and it's released to much critical acclaim. Winona's nominated for an Academy Award, a BAFTA, which for those who don't know is the chic British Academy Award, and a Golden Globe. She wins the Golden Globe. And for anyone who's ever won a Golden Globe, like me, you know it's totally meaningless.
So it's been reported that it was during this production that Winona understood that she might be a little too dependent on the pills that she was prescribed for that good old breakup anticipatory nostalgia. She said, quote, "I got over it. I have Michelle Pfeiffer to thank for that. She told me to flush them down the toilet." So I want to talk to you about this because in the last episode, we touched on the fact that a bitch can die from benzodiazepine withdrawal if it's not medically supervised. So I found this statement a little slightly unbelievable, a little bit like that's a nice story. But
I'll tell you what would happen if you were taking that, if you were eating Klonopin like candy and then you flushed it down the toilet. If you didn't die, which there's a high potential that you would be in a level of withdrawal that would be intolerable to a person. Like, I will tell you this, which is that when I realized that I was dependent on Klonopin, I was like, great, I'm just going to get off this at home. I'm going to go stay with my parents for a couple of weeks and just kick this.
Oh, right. You always think it's going to be like, oh, it's just going to be like an annoying day and a half.
You think it's going to be like a boring Christmas vacation.
Yeah.
And I just like planted myself in the back of my parents' apartment on a little mattress. And I remember being like, I'm not going to take it. And it's like maybe 8 hours, 9 hours into not taking it. And suddenly I go, wow, I can't feel my arms. I just can't feel them.
That's scary.
And it was really scary. And then I realized like, oh, it's not going to work. I was like, and I can barely see. Oh, it's not going to work this way. So when I realized I needed to be in a facility, that's when they start titrating you down. And like this will give you just this tight story gives you an example of what it felt like, which is that every Tuesday at rehab, they would take my Klonopin down like half a milligram.
No. You know?
So on Tuesday. Cursed Tuesday also was Taco Tuesday.
To look forward to and something to dread.
Except that when they would take my Klonopin down, it'd be like fine for about an hour. And then suddenly this like anxiety would hit me that I can only describe as like, it feels like your hair is blowing off your head. Every cell in your body is vibrating. And I couldn't eat. I couldn't even swallow. So I remember just this feeling of like, why does it have to happen on Tuesdays? Because I never get to enjoy the tacos. And they
Can I suggest something?
Yeah.
Were you feeling as though your prison was also your wings? That Tuesday was your prison, but also your wings.
Yes. And for anyone who wonders what that beautiful piece of poetry was, listen to part one. That Tuesday was my prison and my wings. And they would always leave a box with my name on it in the fridge that had like leftover Taco Tuesday.
Oh, bendito.
It was so fucking sad.
Were you like, I can't even have any fun here?
Yeah. Anyway, this is all to say that flushing your Klonopin down the toilet if you flush opiates down the toilet, you are going to just like feel like you have the flu for a shitty few weeks.
You will want to reach your hand down that fucking toilet drain and see if you can dig out a loose one.
Yeah, of course.
So anyway, back to Winona. So she says that she's absolved herself of this addiction by flushing the pills down the toilet at this moment when she's getting this kind of acclaim. She wins this Golden Globe. She's nominated for all this shit.
And she's also nominated by the press as someone who fucked Daniel Day-Lewis, a nomination I would also like to receive.
I mean, who could blame her? So these rumors are circulating that she and Daniel Day-Lewis are doing it. She's started dating This band is so antique. None of you bitches have heard of it. Soul Asylum frontman Dave Perner. I was alive during this time, and I can't even name one of their songs, but they were very famous.
And also, everyone's like, Dave Perner left his girlfriend of 13 years because everyone liked to be like, Winona is a whore who ruins lives.
Oh, yeah. And this is going to be like the narrative that follows her romantic life for many years to come. They're going to be like, don't, if Winona Ryder sees your boyfriend standing on the hill outside of the front of your house, she's going to do it with him. Like, this is the reputation that follows her. So her and Dave Perner would stay together until 1996, but this coupledom sets off a chain of rumored high-profile entanglements with men in the music and entertainment industries. Like, there are television specials that would run on VH1 in the 90s that were just devoted. It's called, actually, I'll give you the name of it. You can watch it yourself. It's called Love Chain, and it's just dedicated to kind of examining the chronology of her romantic life. So there are many of them.
And she denied being romantically involved with a lot of them, but it did provoke another queen who I'm shocked we haven't really covered on this C word situation, Courtney Love. She said, "You're no one in the rock industry unless you feuded with me or slept with Winona Ryder."
Courtney Love, call us up. Call us.
Mm-hmm.
So the other thing I want to say about all of these rock stars that she went out with is that there was a moment when I wanted to do like the Reputation recap at the head of this episode that was just lyrics from songs that are purported to be about her, because there are so many. There are so many. So just Google like songs about Winona Ryder and you can read about them yourselves. And you can read like the nasty comments that the artists made about her following their breakups.
Are any of the songs mean?
Yes. There's like a whole album of mean songs.
That's so fascinating.
Yes.
So, okay. So 1994 is a big year for Winona. To me, this is apex Winona. She stars in Reality Bites, which at the time was not a big critical or commercial success, but it becomes another entry in the Winona Ryder cult canon. I will also say this. Reality Bites is interesting because to me, this is the moment that really takes Winona from like kind of angsty teen outsider to quintessential Gen X woman. Because it's like before this, she's always playing these kind of like either teenagers or period pieces.
Lots of period pieces.
And this is the moment where it's like, oh, Winnie is an adult ass fucking woman.
She's an adult ass fucking woman. So she's like, you know, there are interviews with her again with, I don't know why she was always on that Bobby Ladies show. They do like 5-minute interviews. And there's an interview about Reality Bites where Bobby's like, "Did you enjoy being in Reality Bites?" And Winona's like, "It was fine. It was like a really easy, fluffy, fine movie." So she's not like particularly proud of this role, regardless of the fact that it goes on to be like a major cultural touchstone. Well, but she is probably very proud of her turn as Jo March in Little Women.
Yep. So she goes hard at Jo March, and she would later say she chose to do the movie in part because she'd gotten involved in the search for Polly Klass, a 12-year-old girl from her hometown of Petaluma who'd been kidnapped from her bedroom during a sleepover. And so Ryder offered a $200,000 reward for Klass's safe return.
Can we also say, go back to episode one if you haven't heard it, because she used to have these horrible bad fantasies about being kidnapped. So this happens in the town where she's from. It directly mirrors anxieties that she claimed to have had as a kid. And she really gets in there and does a lot of work to keep this story in the headlines.
And it's kind of oddly beautiful because so much of the time celebrities choose a cause that like makes them look heroic, or a cause that's like easy to, you know, like, I don't know, let's get some clean water in bottles to people. And she's really going, which is good.
Nice
and whatever.
Work, guys.
Nice work, assholes. But it's like in this, she's really making herself a part of these people's family. And it's like, it's a very publicly emotional act, and it's kind of moving. And after it was revealed that Polly had been murdered, which is not the ideal outcome, Polly's parents gave Winona their daughter's beloved copy of Little Women. And so months later, when the script landed in her hands, it all felt quite fateful.
So after a lot of suspicion on the part of studios and producers that a movie that is about girls could be successful, Little Women is a commercial and critical hit. Winona is nominated for Best Actress in a Leading Role Academy Award. She loses to Queen Jessica Lange. That's
and
all right.
Let's just say, is this her second nomination or her third?
This is her second nomination.
So, like, this woman is, we have to remember, like, this woman isn't just a cultural figure. She is cleaning up in terms of public accolades. And
I think what makes the rest of this story so confusing to people, because she has this major career momentum. She has like a solidified spot within public consciousness. And there's a moment when it's like, you know, and I guess this is the thing about the apex. You can either plateau for a while or you can descend. So there's this point where you think she's like a part of culture and she's not going anywhere, and she fucking disappears.
Well, what's really also interesting to me is if you look at the career of any very like heavily nominated actress, being an actress, there is always a moment where people are going to decide you no longer have quote unquote it. Like, I like to think that, I mean, I'm not an actress like these people, but I like to think that I already lived through my moment of plateau and public skepticism. But I know that there will be others if I want to continue to have a long career, because it's just what it looks like. But say if you look at, like, Renee Zellweger before she came back and did Judy, or
right.
the moment in Nicole Kidman's career when she did Australia and everyone was like, is it done? Like, there's always, unless you're Meryl Streep, there is always a moment where people start to ask the question, does she still have it? And what was interesting is that Winona, and we'll get to this, before people could ask the question, took herself out of the game. And also, as we are looking at this big, long stretch of successful films, you look really beautiful today, Alyssa. As we're looking
Thank at this you so much.
Big, long stretch, I'm wearing a fleece that I got to go to rehab in to celebrate this. So as we're looking at this big, long stretch of acclaim, it's also interesting to note that now that we look at the whole story, Winona is achieving all this under huge amounts of emotional duress. She's not like out living the dream and like, you know, hanging out by her pool. She's not like a girl boss starting a production company. She's in a kind of private hell, and yet she's continuing to hit her marks in this way that appeals to the public. So this is...
Lost to Jessica Lange. So in 1996... Yeah. Oh, I have a story about this movie that I'm going to tell quickly. I have a story about The Crucible, and that story is that when it came out, me and my mother went to the movies, and we wanted to see the John Travolta vehicle, Michael, about a bad angel. And we were in line waiting to buy the tickets, and some kid behind us who's like 8 years old was like, who would ever go see such a stupid movie as Michael? And me and my mom looked at each other. And then when we got up to the ticket counter, we were like, two tickets for The Crucible, please.
That's so funny.
So she's starring alongside Daniel Day-Lewis again. People were probably thinking like, are these two doing it again? But they're also speculating that she's doing it with David Duchovny and maybe Dave Grohl and maybe Dodi Al-Fayed. And then maybe, once again, I'm going to say this as many times as I can, Alyssa Bennett's close personal friend, Evan Dando of the Lemonheads.
Well, the other interesting thing is that at this moment, she decides that she's going to star in a movie about like a sexual witch hunt, as she's the product of a sexual witch hunt. So, you know, I saw Goody...
That's interesting.
I saw Goody Ryder doing it with Dodi Al-Fayed. You know, like that is the spirit of this.
She's also... really, I think I rewatched this twice because I watched it during my marathon. And then I was like, oh, my son can probably watch this. And we went to Salem and did a tour. And then we went home and watched the movie. And she's really fucking great in it. Like, you look at this performance, I think her performances can be very uneven. And I think that the ones that kind of garnered a lot of critical praise are not her best performances. Like, I don't think she's incredible in Age of Innocence, but when you watch her in The Crucible, it's like a really transportive performance that I think is really incredible.
And also, probably a part of that is she seems like someone, and we'll get to this later with Girl Interrupted, and also, like, when she has a close personal connection to something, like she did with Little Women, like she did with Girl Interrupted, she does her best work. And I have a really strong feeling that The Crucible spoke to her about her experience as celebrity.
Yes, I think you're probably right, because these are charges, like the sort of vixen charges had been following her since she was 15 years old, with even maybe a little younger, but definitely 15 at Rob Lowe. It's already kind of trailing her.
And so, the other thing that's also, and I'm sorry we're stopping so much in this to talk theory, but the other thing that's interesting is like, we live in a moment now where it's like, or resuscitating the conversation around what we did to Britney Spears or Lindsay Lohan, but it was like Winona just missed the deadline for people to revisit. And so she's not even now getting that feeling of justice where people are like, we're sorry, Winona Ryder, we shouldn't have.
Guess what? We got you, bitch. We got you, Noni.
Noni, so we're supporting you.
This is a weird moment. So she does the Crucible. It's really incredible. She's like at this point where she can become a different kind of star, right? Like she's done these indie films. She has cred. She's done like all these period pieces. She's like at a moment where she can really become like a megastar, right?
Yeah. So she's done Boys with Lucas Haas.
That's a very weird movie. So she makes this decision to be in 1997 sci-fi action movie Alien Resurrection. And it's a very strange choice, but you kind of understand that she's seeing what kind of vehicle she can get, like how expansive the vehicles can be.
And she's trying to sort of see the big picture, which is like, do I have a chance to step out of indie girl and become like super megastar?
Right.
But Noni's a gentle and fragile person, and she's not only playing outside genre and dealing with a very demanding physical role, but the film's major scenes involved complex aquatic stunts that she performed herself, despite a longtime phobia of water that developed when she almost drowned at age 12. Let's just say, like, if I had to do a movie that involved a water tank, bitch, I would be replaced 2 hours in because I'd be shivering and crying.
I mean, when you hear about, because she did a lot of interviews about kind of the making of this movie, and when you hear kind of technically what it took to, and physically what it took to film these scenes, it's really fucking scary. It sounds really horrifying. But the thing that comes out of this is not only that the film, it grosses a lot of money, but the reviews are not good. And people think that she was miscast. But the thing that also comes out is that tabloids are later going to charge that during the filming of this movie, she injured a disc in her back and was prescribed narcotic pain medication. Do we know? No, we weren't there.
We 100% were not there.
But it does become a moment, like when people are looking retrospectively to try to pinpoint where things started to shift, this is kind of the moment. So after this film, she doesn't work for 2 years. She says it's a conscious choice because she wasn't finding any scripts that she liked. And in the meantime, she's working very hard to try to get Girl Interrupted made.
Yeah, and that's her passion project. And I think that this is the moment where she's also sort of like, she's always been disillusioned, but it's becoming clear to her that the love of the people is fickle and that her satisfaction is not necessarily going to come from acing the Hollywood game.
And also probably becoming aware, like we touched on in part one, that culture has frozen her in a very specific moment and in a very specific kind of character. And she's going to have a really hard time breaking out of that.
I'm also going to say this, which is like, this is all projection, but I think Noni's kind of deep. And I think that when you are, and we see this again and again, I think like the people who do the best in Hollywood in a long-term way actually have kind of like a buoyant inner happiness that kind of like allows them to just like flit between public experiences. And there needs to be something kind of absent in you to like be comfortable with all this attention and not break.
But maybe more so with women, that's who succeeds. Because I think with men, just think about Daniel Day-Lewis, like method acting his way through, or Gary Oldman, method acting his way through. And we look at these people as performers and we think, oh, the power of the performance is in the fact that the well is so deep. So I think, you know, we treat women very differently in entertainment careers.
Yeah.
So I think that this moment is kind of important. So when you were growing up with Winona, as I did, it was not within my imagination that she would become best friends with noted blonde person Gwyneth Paltrow. But guess what, Lena Dunham? By 1997, these two are inseparable. They lived together at one point following the Paltrow-Pitt breakup. And when Gwyneth started dating Ben Affleck, she was really excited to romantically crisscross his best friend and hers so that everyone could hang out together all the time.
Oh, yeah.
So in early 1998, Winona attends a pre-Academy Awards party with Matt Damon, who is literally just announced his breakup with Minnie Driver on the Oprah Winfrey Show.
And by the way, Minnie Driver, if you've ever had the chance to talk to her, is fabulous. I mean, I would not break up with her for all the money in the world. She is deep. She is powerful. But you know what? It seems that Matt Damon at that point had interesting taste in women because Minnie Driver is fab. Winona Ryder is fab. But guess what? that much overlap. You lose them the way you found them, girl.
So Winona also at this point has a reputation as like a total man eater, with many whispering that she is not deterred by a wedding ring or a girlfriend. And so of course there was a lot of chatter that there is driver-rider overlap. We weren't invited to any of these things.
Driver to rider, it's like basically the same name.
Truly, we don't know.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing.
And Bubba Wallace.
You know what's the worst part of a race? A rain delay.
Sitting around, waiting for the track to dry, is dull.
But instead of waiting, we hang out with Chumba Casino.
Social casino slots, bingo, solitaire, plenty of fun to keep us entertained.
So why let a rain delay slow you down? Play now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
What the heck is going on with all these promotional popcorn buckets? The giant shorts that all of Gen Z is wearing now? And whatever the heck Hyrox is? I'm comedian and certified hater Matt Belisai, and these are the types of questions I'm demanding answers to on my podcast, What the Heck with Matt Belisai. Listen or watch every Thursday as I rant about all the internet trends, pop culture stories, and personal mayhem that makes me scream, What the Heck? Follow What the Heck with Matt Belisai wherever you get your podcasts.
The first few weeks back at school set the tone for the entire year. But with new teachers, schedules, and expectations, it can feel like a lot. If you're looking to help your child start strong and stay confident, I've been using IXL to make that transition so much easier. IXL is an award-winning online learning platform that helps kids truly understand what they're learning. Whether they're building math confidence, strengthening reading and writing skills, or reviewing science concepts, from pre-K through 12th grade, it adapts to each child's level and pace, making it easy to spot and close learning gaps in just a few minutes a day before those gaps can snowball. Plus, it's trusted nationwide. 1 in 4 students in the U.S. are learning with IXL, and it's used in 96 of the top 100 school districts in the U.S. It's an easy, cost-effective way to get kids back into a learning routine and walking into class feeling ready and reassured. Make an impact on your child's learning. Get IXL now. Listeners can get an exclusive 20% off an IXL membership when they sign up today at IXLlearning.com/audio. Visit IXLlearning.com/audio to get the most effective learning program out there at the best price.
So this is where it gets quite juicy. There are also rumors around this time that Winona was supposed to play the lead in Shakespeare in Love, until Gwyneth came over one day, saw the script, and ended up stealing the role.
I'm going to steal your role.
We don't know. We weren't there, but there were items in the press as early as 1994 attaching Winona to the film.
So we have to say this also, that in 2009, Gwyneth, noted blonde person Gwyneth Paltrow, wrote a blind item of her own in Goop about a certain, quote, frenemy who was, quote, venomous and who she claimed tried to take her down. So Gwyneth wrote, quote, one day, I'm going to read this like I am Gwyneth Paltrow.
Great.
One day I heard that something unfortunate and humiliating had happened to this person, and my reaction was deep relief and happiness. Woof. Obviously, everyone speculated that this was about Winona. We don't know. We weren't there.
Also, Alyssa, during the creation of this episode, the passion with which you sent me so many blind items that I was like, I can't even answer all of these.
They're crazy. I started looking into these blinds because I thought that they might give me some kind of clue to help me figure out what I didn't know that had happened to this career. I find it very strange that this career got derailed. I'm talking about Winona's, not Gwyneth Paltrow's. And I was like ransacking the internet for unsubstantiated and often vicious rumors. And I understood that this is kind of precisely the problem. Like, we feel as a public like we are owed explanations, both for personal and kind of career-oriented behaviors. We want to know why. We want to know what. We want to know where. We feel like we are owed scandals. We feel like the private details of public lives should be searchable with Google. And the really fucked up thing is that they are.
Yep. And that's what we can say about that on that. So after her 2-year hiatus, which, by the way, in Hollywood's a V-long time, For anyone, it's a long time. Winona finally started filming Girl Interrupted in early 1999. During the filming of this extremely intense film about mental illness, you will not be surprised to know her insomnia and anxiety attacks returned. She got the flu, but it didn't matter. She's fucking terrific in this movie. She's really fantastic. And by the way, this is when the idea of borderline personality disorder really came into public consciousness. And it's interesting that this is the woman who brought it to us.
And it's still great. This movie is still great. So this is supposed to be a major moment for Winona. It was clearly a moment when she was kind of aiming for the next level. She handpicked this film. She worked on realizing it for 6 years. And she related very deeply to the content. So she did a press blitz that sort of announced her vulnerability to the world. She helped produce it. And she was involved in its casting. This bitch wanted an Academy Award. I believe this bitch wanted an Academy Award for this role.
Yeah. And what actually happened is that everyone was like, wow, who is this fresh-faced, big-lipped, and relatively unknown Angelina Jolie person? Bitch dressed up like a witch, kissed her brother, and she won that Oscar.
She
dressed like a witch in like who do you think made that dress?
That's how you think that I dressed in college.
You did.
I think that dress was like McQueen or something. I don't know. God bless. So the thing that happens is when Angelina Jolie wins this Oscar, everyone's like, oh, Winona must be really mad because she wanted that Oscar. But Winona will come out later and say that she had picked Angelina Jolie to play Lisa Rowe after seeing her performance as former C-word subject Gia Carangi in the HBO biopic. She over and over and over again said that she was not jealous. She was not mad. But we looked at the situation. We were like, she's mad.
Yeah, she's really mad. There's just no way. Also, sidebar, shout out to another favored C-word subject, Brittany Murphy, for her extremely underrated performance in this film. She was absolutely incredible. This is also how Brittany and Winona became very close friends, which is important to us. And Alyssa even found for sale on the internet from the estate of Brittany Murphy some Christmas cards for, what did she call Brittany again? What was her nickname for her? My precious little blueberry, she said. I love you so much it hurts my stomach, but it also makes me strong. And on another note, she wrote, my beautiful, sweet blueberry princess on her birthday. I love you. You're forever in my heart. Love, Noni Berry.
I also found a picture, two different pictures of them wearing the same shoes. So it was like they were close. I was like, this proves how close they were. Like they were sharing clothes. But the press sees these two together and they're like, they're lesbians.
By the way, was Winona even nominated for this movie?
No.
So sad. And ultimately, Girl Interrupted didn't even do that well, despite all of this. But it has become a cult favorite for a very specific kind of girl who also loves the book Prozac Nation.
Oh, Elizabeth Wurtzel, I'd love to do a C-word on you.
So, Elizabeth Wurtzel, we miss you.
Oh, R.I.P. So after Brittany's death, Winona said that she was no longer able to watch Girl Interrupted.
Couldn't take it.
Yeah.
So moving on, in early 2000, after months of rumors about a split, Winona and Matt Damon officially break up. And you have to remember that at this point, like Matt Damon now is Matt Damon, but at that point he was like Oscar-winning indie hot boy Matt Damon. It wasn't like breaking up with Dave Perner. It was a bigger deal.
He still looked like he was like going to the country club though.
Yeah.
He's got country club face.
He's got a bad case of country club face.
So the rest of the year is sort of like, that's like, meh.
People don't really love these next two movies, do they?
No. Oh my God. These next two movies are appalling. Have you seen Autumn in New York?
I rewatched Autumn in New York like last year for reasons I don't even understand, which is basically it's a movie in which Winona Ryder has a terminal illness and like Richard Gere's having feelings about it. It's roughie.
It's really bad. So she does that. She does something called Lost Souls and she's still working, but her long winning streak is over. And she will later say about this time in her life, quote, I went from weirdo teenager to pixie waif to them not knowing what the hell to do with me. sucks.
And you can tell that she was confused during this period. Her hair gets lighter. She dresses in a trendier way. And she's trying to once again figure out how to grow up because she knows there's no end game unless she can.
And there are a lot of later performances where filmmakers try to kind of convince us that Winona Ryder would like wear business casual suits or like have frosted tips. And we like her better as a symbol than we like her as an actress. So when she's trying to act her way out of her like misfit teenage adolescent life, we look at it and we're like, not really. Like, this bitch doesn't work down the DMV.
No, you certainly don't. So in spring 2001, she cameos on an episode of Friends, which at this point was a pretty public, that was like pretty like mainstream girl thing to do and huge. But tabloids make the suggestion she's been a diva on set, hit on Brad Pitt in front of Jennifer Aniston, because by this point we automatically romantically involve her with the boyfriends of other women. Also, something that we love to do, as you noted, Alyssa, is frame Aniston as a jealous and vulnerable sad sack who can't hold on to a man. But that's another story.
Right. I think that's true. So that year, she also shoots this Adam Sandler movie, Mr. Deeds. Mm-hmm. While she's on that set, during filming, she breaks her arm and she's prescribed some painkillers for this.
And I will say this, as someone who's broken their arm on a set before, that what happens is like, you can't just do what normal people do, which is put your arm in a cast and rest it. They need you back on set with no cast. So in order to be able to use your arm in a way that feels realistic, you've got to be doped up.
Right, right.
I mean, you don't have to be, but that's what the situation creates. And luckily, opiates were never my thing of choice. But I remember, like, they were just in endless supply when I broke my arm on set.
Yeah, they were like, you want another? So yep. Then in August of that year, it was reported that Winona had to back out of a production at the last minute for the second time in her career. She had flown to London to begin shooting some movie called Lily and the Secret Planting, but had developed and been hospitalized for a severe gastrointestinal infection, leading her to return to Los Angeles. And if this were 1989, it could have been like the biggest Winona gossip of the year. But guess what? It doesn't even compare to what's to come. Does not compare.
Also, I just want to note that if I abruptly stopped taking opiates, I'd have a gastric infection too. But I'm not saying that's what happened.
No, you're talking about yourself. You're talking about yourself. Mm-hmm. So everyone, people of the world, congratulations. You've stuck with it. And we've arrived at the infamous shoplifting incident that Lena Dunham and I can't fucking wait to talk about.
And I do want to preface this by saying that we are coming at the incident with love. We are coming at it with support. We've been hashtag free Winona from the beginning. We're not here to shill for Saks Fifth Avenue. We're here to support our girl as she goes into a very trying time. Yes, Alyssa?
That's it. So on December 12th, 2001, Winona was arrested at Saks Fifth Avenue in Beverly Hills after being caught on tape stealing $5,500 worth of designer clothes and accessories. She was reportedly in the store for an hour and a half. She had a number of items that she'd paid for. So just add this into the story, because when you watch the tape on YouTube.com, it only shows like, I don't know, 20 seconds of her kind of wandering around and dragging a bunch of garment bags.
Well, here's what I want to say. She just turned 30 years old. This is 3 months after 9/11. And I want you to read the purported list of what she took and the prices.
Oh my God, I love this. Okay. There was a $760 Marc Jacobs thermal cashmere sweater. I remember this collection. It was very luxurious. There was a $750 Yves Saint Laurent white blouse. There was a $225 Eric Javits hat. There were four handbags, including a $540 Notori handbag. There were several Frederick Fekkai hairbands and bows, totaling $600. There were six packs of socks, including an $80 pair of Donna Karan cashmere socks. And she had a $1,595 white Gucci dress that I believe they didn't discover she'd stolen until later when they reviewed the security tape.
I mean,
so the way that this goes down is that someone, apparently like a security guard from the store, they're like tracking her because she's acting kind of erratically. And a security guard watches through the slats in a changing room as she produces a pair of scissors from her purse and begins cutting out the security tags on these garments. So she's like, and this is going to be important when we start to talk about like what it really meant that she was taking things here. Like, she's destroyed several items that could no longer be like they couldn't be sold anymore. They had holes in them. So they watch her doing this. They watch her apparently like putting things into the hat and sticking them on her head and like just shoving shit into a shopping bag and then walking out. So she gets caught and she tries out a couple of different stories, as you do.
You always do. So the first one is, she said she was just researching a role for a film called White Jazz and her director told her to do it. Note, there is absolutely no shoplifting in White Jazz.
Number two, she said she was just researching a role for a film called Shop Girl and that her director told her to do it. Note, there is no shoplifting in Shop Girl. Number three, she was like, my assistant did it.
But how is that possible? Her assistant wasn't even in the store.
Well, exactly. They're like, how is this possible? Your assistant's not even in the store. And then she was like, oh, I thought my assistant paid for everything. And everyone was like, sure, Noni.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, to this day, Winona kind of says, like, the truth of what happened isn't really, like, it's not really public. People don't really know what happened. But I want to talk about, you know, the big reaction to the story is, like, why would this woman who definitely has millions of dollars and is incredibly famous and has, we think, everything she could ever want, why would she steal? So I have to say, I would assume, being a student of Winona Ryder now, she must have felt watched and taken from her entire adult life. Also, her entire adolescent life. Her career had hit a lull. She was no longer a hot property hounded by paparazzi. She was becoming invisible for the first time in her life. And maybe she thought that she would take back some of what had been stolen from her.
Yep.
You know, and you and I did some research into, we're not diagnosing her. I'm not a doctor. I'm just a student of bad behavior, a professor of bad behavior. But
you're a student and a professor. And when the student becomes the professor, it's both their prison and their wings.
It's my prison, my wings. So within the diagnostic statistical manual, when they describe kleptomania, which is diagnostically related to other impulse control disorders, like trichotillomania, which I thought was really interesting, eating disorders, addiction, substance abuse, they're all kind of within this pod together. But one of the things that people who are in recovery from kleptomania often say is that they feel that they've been overgivers or that they've been taken from too much in their life, that they give people too much. They feel like they're overly generous. If that's like something monetary or if it's something emotional, they feel like they've given too much and there's this great need to like balance the scale. And there's also this idea that there's usually very little satisfaction in the act of stealing. The items that a kleptomaniac takes, they almost never use. So they give them away or they hoard them or they hide them. And I think that when we go back and think about her literally taking things that were destroyed when she cut the tags out of them, we have to understand that she has no intention of using these.
And also this idea of like kind of transposing the ways that you feel robbed or the ways that you feel victimized onto sort of your own criminal actions.
Right. It's like, look at, see me, see my trauma. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, I think it's important to differentiate between kleptomania and shoplifting. Shoplifting is generally typified by theft that is related to both a lack of money and a need. So shoplifting is like stealing food and you have no money in your pocket, stealing diapers from a store because you can't pay for them. That's shoplifting. Kleptomania, in contrast, is unplanned. The person that engages in kleptomania typically will have enough money on their person or on a credit card to buy whatever it is that they're taking. So it's not a need-based crime. Kleptomaniacs often say that they don't understand or they won't know that they've done it. They're like in some kind of fugue state and they don't know what they've taken until they're out of the store.
Right.
Right. So in the weeks following her arrest, which obviously was like major news, it's reported that she checked herself into the psychiatric ward at Cedars-Sinai and was on suicide watch. Everyone is berserk over it. We wait for the trial. And when it actually happens, the prosecution wants it to be as public as possible. Fucking sucks. Sucks for her.
The whole thing is a horrifying public spectacle. That is also, the other thing is she was always embroiled in scandal, but her version of scandal was like more high rent. Like her version of scandal was like, someone took my Shakespeare in Love part, or I'm breaking up with Matt Damon.
Right, like this behavior we have no explanation for, which is why it becomes such a moment. We cannot explain it.
Yep.
So stories start to come out after this arrest. It comes out that she had been suspected of shoplifting three other times, twice at Barney's, and then once she had been accused of shoplifting at Neiman Marcus, and there was tape of this. So this is kind of, you know, this starts to come out about her, and people are like, hey, my store too. She did this at my store too.
And people probably before were like, we're going to keep this quiet because we like, it's interesting for how long people's behavior can be protected.
Right.
Until one person just decides like your celebrity cannot protect you.
Right, exactly.
So her sentence was pretty basic. 3 years probation, 480 hours of community service and drug counseling. Which, by the way, that is a lot of motherfucking hours of community service. But during the trial, a lot is revealed. And one of the things is that during the arrest, she had been in possession of a syringe, bottles of Demerol and diazepam, 6 Valiums, 40 Vicuprofens, 2 Vicodins, 2 Percocets, a Percodan, and a morphine sulfate capsule. So that is a lot of drugs. And can I ask one question? Do you think the syringe was to inject painkillers?
Yeah, of course. She had liquid Demerol. It was a hypodermic needle. Of course.
Wow.
So I think that if we had just been privy to the information that came out in the trial, we would have known some of this. But what ended up happening is that the probation record was somehow transmitted to the smoking gun. So you can read this probation record. I think it's 27 pages. It's so personal. It has such intimate information in it, so much detail about these medications that were found, about people calling the police and making unsubstantiated claims about Winona's drug use, about her life. It's not like a thing that someone like me should be able to read, but it's out there floating around.
And this is the place where her story coincides with the story of one Dr. Lussman. It has been widely reported that Dr. Lussman wrote prescriptions for Winona and for other notable people, such as her one-time pal Courtney Love. And her prescription pseudonym was Emily Thompson. So Dr. Lussman is what we call a Dr. Feelgood. He's been under investigation by the California Medical Board, but it's Winona's arrest, and more importantly, all the pills that she was arrested with, that lead the authorities to search Dr. Lussman's office, home, and car. And he has his license revoked and pleads no contest to charges of grand theft and practicing medicine without a license.
So a ton of medical information is publicized. We know when Winona asked for more pills. We know how many pills she asked for. It comes out that she'd been signed up for cosmetic laser surgery, but there are no records of a procedure or even an exam performed that day. Just the extra Vicoprofen, Xanax, and a third unknown drug that she was given. And all this info comes from Winona's probation report, which we just discussed. And this report says that she had 37 prescriptions filled by 20 different doctors over a 3-year time period.
It's a roughie. And so all this info comes out, and having all of this public is insane. Not only is it emotionally invasive and terrifying, but the other thing that we have to remember is that this makes her virtually uninsurable.
This is humiliating. It's fucking humiliating.
And basically what she's realizing is that like anyone who she would want to work with knows this. Anyone who she would want to date knows this. So she tries to get ahead of the story. She hosts SNL where she's to tell 1 million kleptomania jokes, and she makes fun of herself, and she wears a free Winona t-shirt on the cover of W. But she also never apologizes. And this makes people mad because they really want to see the like women go, I was broken and now I'm fixed. And she's not doing it.
Also, I think that, I know from reading comments sections, something that happens is that we want her to apologize for her behavior because we think you have everything. You have everything and you're going to commit this crime that has no real reason that we can understand. To us, it's just like a rich person who feels entitled to take more than their share in every way possible. She's more beautiful than us. She's more famous than us. She's more talented than us. She has access to more things than we do. When this comes out and she kind of has to dodge the humiliation that's attached to it, we are enraged. We want her to mea culpa. We want her to explain why she did it. We want her to tell us what it is in her life that has made her a drug addict. We want more from her. And she's kind of like, I've already given enough. I'm humiliated. My life feels over. I'm trying to get through this.
Well, after things peter out, it's pretty clear that her career is dead for the moment. She disappears, she leaves LA, and she moves back to North California in San Francisco, back to her hometown. Total humiliation.
I've always dreamed of being able to order my coffee in Italian like a local, instead of just pointing at the menu and hoping for the best. There's something about speaking another language with real confidence that opens up a whole new world of experiences. That's why I'm so excited about Rosetta Stone Sapphire. It's their biggest launch in over a decade. It takes that research-backed method we all know and trust and adds fresh, cutting-edge features that make it easier than ever to go from knowing a few phrases to speaking naturally about the topics you actually care about. What I love is that you aren't just memorizing vocabulary lists. You learn entirely in your new language through visuals and audio, just like you did as a kid. One of my favorite new features is chat missions. It turns conversation practice into a game, putting you in real-world scenarios, like ordering at a restaurant or asking for directions, and giving you missions to complete. You get real-time feedback along the way, so you build that confidence before you ever have to use your skills in the real world. If you want to take your language skills to the next level, don't wait to try Rosetta Stone Sapphire. Listeners of this podcast can get 20% off their Rosetta Stone Sapphire subscription when they sign up today. This gets you access to Rosetta Stone Sapphire in 25 languages. Visit rosettastone.com/rs10 to redeem your 20% off. That's rosettastone.com/rs10.
Tastes have changed since Bob's Discount Furniture opened its first store in 1991, but not the way they do business. At Bob's, I know I can get today's styles, like feature-packed bedroom sets with storage and charging, or real marble dining sets, all at 90s-era prices. Plus, with no money down financing options and fast shipping, you don't have to wait months to get your furniture. So, stop into your local Bob's store this Labor Day weekend and celebrate 35 years of doing things the Bob's way.
So we don't really see Winona for much of the 2000s. In 2003, Woody Allen, of all people.
Of all goddamned people. Of all people. Keep your mouth shut, Woody.
Tells reporters that he couldn't insure her to cast her in a film. The shoplifting fiasco was like the nail in the coffin of a string of kind of clunky, not great roles.
So in 2005, she's again accused of shoplifting by a small boutique in Los Angeles, which of course we as a society love.
Oh, what yeah.
do you think?
We love it.
Do you think
it.
This was them just trying to like get their name out, or do you think that she did more shoplifting?
You know, these shoplifting accusations are going to continue to come up. Like this thing that happened at Saks is not the final time she's accused of it. I don't know. Like, I think that if she does, and we're not doctors. We don't know. We weren't there. I think that if she does have
an addiction,
that it doesn't end just because you've been humiliated. Because I think part of kleptomania is that you already feel humiliated. So I don't think that like public shaming makes the shame you already feel go away.
Yeah. And what I love is in later years, when Winona opens up about her painkiller addiction, she says of the shoplifting incident that she remembers just being confused, which sounds exactly accurate to me. Like,
yeah.
You don't know what's happening. You don't know where you are. If you've got that much Demerol in you, God damn it. You shouldn't even be in a store. But in 2007, she told Vogue that she didn't feel particularly guilty about it because she didn't hurt anybody. And I love that attitude.
Yeah, I love it too. But again, I think that we as a society don't love it in general because we think you have so much. What fucking right do you have? What right do you have? So we condemn her for this. So she remains very much off the grid from this point for many years. For all intents and purposes, she seemed very much a relic of the 90s. We will say, though, that in recent years, she's described this hiatus as a good thing for her. And in 2016, she said, "Psychologically, I must have been at a place where I just wanted to stop. I won't get into what happened, but it wasn't what people think. And it wasn't like the crime of the century, but it allowed me time that I really needed, where I went back to San Francisco and got back into things that I just had other interests, frankly."
And I'm looking right now at the picture of her on where she said this in Vogue. Winona Ryder, starting over at 35.
Oh my God, she was only 35. It's so crazy to me.
That's my age right now, starting over at 35.
Oh man, what a time.
I know. So she's not, like, when she does her back at 35 thing, what movie is she promoting on the cover of Vogue? Are they just like, this is going to be great to kind of like keep this thing alive?
I think she's just like, look, I'm coming back. So she appears in some like Star Trek movie that I didn't watch. I don't know when that comes out. Like, who cares?
Yeah.
And then she's kind of back in the news in 2008 when a worker at a CVS claims that she stole a bunch of makeup. And once more that same year when the Daily Mail says that she overdosed on tranquilizers on a plane heading from LA to London and was said to have collapsed twice before being whisked off to a hospital. Mm-hmm. And at no point are we like, oh, geez, maybe like the perversion of our interest in this person and her problems is like making the problem worse.
No, and we are never considering, like, we're never considering our deep culpability. But there's a few years where you don't really hear anything from her until she plays a small role in Black Swan and we remember, oh my God, this bitch is good.
Yeah, she's good.
This started some Winona could be back whispers after a decade of her dismissal as a once beloved actress whose name couldn't be said without someone's wisecracking uncle making a shoplifting joke.
Yeah, they were like, did she steal the milk from Kraft Services?
I know. It's their favorite. Or if you, like, you know, take something at the table, they're like, don't Winona Ryder that bread.
Right. So tabloids during this period would once in a while publish these sort of Howard Hughes type rumors, which are very disturbing. They would say that Winona was a recluse, that Winona had bleached her hair white and was obsessed with online shopping. And it was as though Winona's weirdness wasn't hot anymore. So this comes up a lot in the C word. You know, you get a little bit older and everything that made you like quirky and sexy and hot as a young person is like disgusting to people once you're over 40.
Well, yeah, it's like the entire idea of like youth allows for a certain intriguing messiness. And then once you like don't conform to people's sense of what an aging woman should do. Meanwhile, George Clooney like still plays pranks and has a pig and he's like 69.
Do you know how old Norma Desmond was supposed to be in Sunset Boulevard? This is like a really, this is really interesting.
I'm scared that it's like 24.
50 years old. So this is like the narrative that's been constructed around women in Hollywood for so long that by 50, you're like a cackling, insane, out of touch wretch.
Yep.
Living with a monkey.
Living with a monkey. And then she had a moment because Stranger Things comes out in 2016. And let's remember, this was a big deal. This was one of Netflix's first big shows, overnight success, and one of, according to some analyses, the biggest shows to come out in 2016. Most importantly, people praised her performance. People loved it. And she did something at the Emmys that made people think she was chic as hell.
You know what else people have said about this performance, though, that I think is interesting, is that people will say that there's something disconcerting about encountering her in the current moment because she has some quality that makes her look both old and young at the same time. Like, people will be like, she looks like an old teenager, and it freaks me out. But I think that that is because of how we have cemented her within culture, within popular culture, and that's as a young person.
Yep, 100%. And she can't stop also being a subject of interest. Remember when Stranger Things won Best Drama at the Emmys?
She was making these faces that were like, it's like almost hard for me to watch.
If you imagine what kind of faces, what do you think the faces are about if you had to imagine?
I don't know. When I, you know, they say that when you make a face, you feel the feeling. When I make this face, I feel like, where am I?
Yeah.
That's how I feel.
I mean, maybe she was like, I can't believe I'm back.
Because you have to move a lot of muscles in your face to make those expressions. Try it.
It's true. Okay. Is that it? Whatever it is, I think what she's responding to is the fact that the speech is fucking insane. So I think she's like, I'm here on stage listening to this insane speech. This guy's saying Hollywood can save us from like the oppressive forces of Trump. This is fucking stupid. And so like she's trying to be like in the club while everyone's so happy about winning. But she's like, guys, I've been nominated for 100 Academy Awards. I've been here a million times. The fact that you think art is going to like save us is cute. Sure, I'll put my fist up. But you guys are psycho and I can't wait to have my champagne. That's my read.
Back to Winona.
Okay.
So she goes on to reunite with Keanu Reeves. I was just going to make a judgment call about his craft, but I won't. And in 2018, romantic comedy.
I think Keanu Reeves is a lovely man. I think he's a lovely man.
He's hot as hell, I'll tell you that. And the 2018 romantic comedy Destination Wedding. And then she acted in HBO's 2020 limited series, The Plot Against America, which must be some kind of adaptation of a what's-his-name book, Philip Roth.
It's an adaptation of a Philip Roth book. And, you know, at a certain point, I just can't with that anymore.
Yeah.
As much as I love and support HBO and love and support all people involved.
I love you so much, HBO. So now Winona is dating some designer called Scott McInlay Hahn. He's got three names. In 2016,
he's hot. I looked him up. He's hot.
If she was asked if they were going to get married, and she replied, I don't want to get divorced.
I mean,
to which I say, it only hurts the first time.
She also said to Rolling Stone in 1991, do you want to give us these closing words, Alyssa?
She said, if anyone ever calls me quirky again, I think they should be shot. Woof.
I think that these final words really kind of lead us into what my wish for Winona would be, which is like our essential need to make a woman's wings her prison and her prison her wings. Means that Winona never had a chance to grow. Like the only way that she could grow in some way was to destroy her own image and start again. And I understand this, like the need to almost set fire to everything so that you can keep moving. And my wish for her would have been that in order to like experience self-actualization, she didn't have to destroy it.
And I guess my wish for her would be kind of what she got, which is I think that she is on her way back to a career. And I hope that this time around she's got better luck. I hope she has a better network of self-protection. I hope that she feels more supported. I hope she doesn't feel stolen from. And I hope that she's able to respect her privacy enough to like, girl, don't let Rolling Stone in your house ever again. Don't let them in your house. Don't go for a drive with someone from fucking Vanity Fair because they're out to get you. They're not out to lift you up. They're out to give you some prison bars. I want to give you some wings.
Yeah, I want to give you some wings, girl. And the other thing is like, I think the mistake that so many people make in the public eye, which is that if we can just be seen again, if we can just be perceived again, it'll be different this time, trying to almost explain ourselves again and again.
Yes.
And it's like having a relationship with a friend who continually lets you know that they like don't have an understanding for you or regard for you. And you just think like, if I show them my vulnerability or if I give them the right present or if I can show up and say the right things.
It's like a fucking cultural booty call. I mean,
yes. You just coined something so important. The term cultural booty call is a real life changer. It's a life changer.
It's real.
And so
it's a cultural booty call. And the person that gets that cultural booty call, you never wake up feeling good. You're not going to wake up feeling good.
No, you're really not. And I think that she never had the chance to self-actualize. And she also never had the chance to prove to people that she was who she felt she was. But what she didn't understand was that proving it to people wasn't the point. And exactly. So there was never going to be like, the thing I've had to finally realize is like, I'm never going to have a satisfying interaction with culture in which I finally feel understood. That will happen once I'm dead and some girls have a different C-word-esque podcast in which they examine my life. And even then, there will be some essential misunderstandings. And so the only thing that you can do is make work that's exciting to you. And the fact is she got so, like, a problem I relate to deeply, which is she got so lost in the sauce of trying to, like, shift public perception on mm-hmm. who she was that the work became secondary. Like, the thing that she started loving doing, which is, I'm a child, and when I act, I feel like I can escape, like, her wings became her prison.
That's so true, because it's also, like, you know, I think what you want when you're a performer or an artist, you obviously want the public to engage in what you do as an artist. And I think that what happened with her is that we so wanted to see beyond the confines of the performance that we got invested in her as like a character. We got invested in real life Winona Laura Horowitz as though she were a character. And then when the performance started to displease us, we fucking ate her alive.
Ate her for fucking breakfast. And that is just the way it goes. So this is one of my favorite episodes we've ever done. I feel like this is why we do C-Word, is so that we can revisit stories like this.
Call us, Winona.
We'd love to take you out to a quiet lunch. No paps.
No paps.
I love you, Alyssa.
I love you too, Lena.
I'm Lena Dunham.
And I'm Alyssa Bennett.
And we will never call you crazy.
The C Word is a Luminary podcast. It's produced by Pineapple Street Studios and Good Thing Going Productions. Our producer is Dina Kleiner, and our associate producers are Sophie Bridges and Zandra Ellen. Jenna Weiss-Berman and Max Linsky are our executive producers. Our theme song is by Liz Fair. Other music is by Matthew McLaughlin and Andrew Miller. Special thanks to Michael Cohen and Blake Mars. Do you like the song that's like, boom, 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 let me hear you say way-o.
Way-o. I said boom, 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 let me hear
everybody
you say.
Everybody say way-o.
I'll give you my best part. Girl, your booty is so fine, and I want to make you mine. If you cannot be with you, maybe I can have a taste. Put your arms boom, around boom, me, girl, and your kisses way-o. On my face.
Boom, boom. Sorry, Dina.